if this population does start recovering, at some point, presumably, we could reduce or remove the conservation measures and remove the economic impact.
A federal agency puts two Alaska fisheries on hold to save endangered sea lions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 9th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, residents of Port Hyden turn to the state for help with aggressive wolves.
They aren't coming in during the day now. They're only coming in at night, and that actually increases the problem. There's a lot of darkness out there this time of year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Fire Island Wind, offering a fuel-free energy alternative to South Central Alaska natural gas. Learn more at fireislandwind.com.
Pacific cod and Atka mackerel fisheries in the Western Aleutian Islands area will be restricted starting January 1st. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries Service issued the final interim ruling yesterday. The move is aimed at protecting Western Aleutian Stellar sea lions, which feed on cod and mackerel. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The new ruling affects only Western Stellar sea lions, which are listed as endangered. Doug DeMaster directs the Alaska Fisheries Science Center for NOAA.
And so the agency, based on genetics and food habits, made a determination that the Western stock and the Eastern stock, to be consistent with the mandates of the Endangered Species Act, they have to be managed as separate populations.
The rule prohibits fishing for Atka mackerel and Pacific cod in one area and reduces fishing in two other areas of the Western Aleutians. Protective measures include establishing a 3-mile buffer zone around sea lion rookeries and fishing closures for Atka mackerel and Pacific cod in sea lion habitat. A biological opinion also issued by the Fisheries Service states that continuing with the current fishing levels is likely to jeopardize the existence of the western population of stellar sea lions, which is declining in the western and central Aleutians, with the most serious declines in the fishing areas now under restriction. The western sea lion population has dropped 45% between 2000 and 2008. The Fisheries Service plans to have the biological opinion reviewed by experts next spring. NOAA is still taking comments on the final interim ruling through its website. DeMaster says the latest ruling does not mean research will cease.
The research that we're doing is designed to see if these conservation measures are working or not. Two, we need to make sure if this population does start recovering, at some point, presumably, we could reduce or remove the conservation measures and remove the economic impact to the fishermen that are being affected.
Alaska's congressional delegation has come out strongly against the fisheries closures. In a joint statement, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich say there is no clear indication that the fishing restrictions will benefit the environment. The senators say the biological opinion could cut in half the lucrative $60 million annual Atka mackerel and Pacific cod fisheries in Alaska, while costing the state much-needed jobs. Senator Begich says the fisheries closure is a disaster for the fishing industry, while he criticizes the NOAA Fisheries Service for not heeding the recommendations of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council on the issue. DeMaster admits the interim final ruling was pushed through because it was needed by January 1st.
It can be implemented right away. It's waiving the 30-day public notice. It requires a 30-day comment period, and there's an intention or an expectation that it will be replaced by a final rule at some point down the road.
He says the agency takes its responsibility of promoting the recovery of the sea lion very seriously. Meanwhile, NOAA is in the process of evaluating the status of the eastern population of the stellar sea lion, which is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The agency this week announced that there is now information that may indicate the species recovery and that delisting the eastern population of sea lions may be warranted. The states of Alaska, Washington, and Oregon have petitioned for the delisting. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The state's coastal management program faces certain termination on July 1st, unless the legislature and governor agree to grant an extension during next year's session. The program began in 1978 with the goal of facilitating development in the state in a way that supported local communities by allowing them to have input into what happened in their areas. However, by the time Governor Frank Murkowski moved the agency out of his office and into the Department of Natural Resources and eliminated the Division of Governmental Coordination portion of the program, its role had diminished. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports that its supporters want it back.
The executive order Governor Murkowski announced during his first State of the State speech in 2003 was not only a surprise to coastal management supporters, but was seen as an assault to their contact with state and federal government. But it responded to developers who had begun to see the program as a burden. The order stated that the change would, quote, provide better access to scientific information and state personnel on projects affecting the coastal zone. It was changed for efficiency to, quote, improve the planning process for projects in the coastal areas. Marilyn Crockett with the Alaska Oil and Gas Association says, despite positive things people saw the program doing at its origin, over its 25 years in existence, the world around it had changed at both the state and federal levels.
The number of laws and regulations that are on the books dealing with protection of the environment, permitting regimes, and so on is exponentially much more substantive today than there was in 1978. So that the need to have the additional focus, if you will, and layer of protection for protecting the nation's coastal zone and Alaska's coastal zone is less today than it was back in 1978.
She says there's also a much stronger presence of environmental activism focusing on Alaska issues than there was at the start of the program. The Coastal Management Program can deal with local, state, and federal governments, but not non-governmental organizations. Kotzebue's Representative Reggie Jewell, one of the program's strongest supporters in the legislature, agrees that the state and the system had changed since its beginnings. He says the mood of the state had changed over the years, in part because of the abundance of resources.
The environmental movement began to grow, and Alaska is a red state. And I think therein, you know, lie, you know, some of the clashes. And so as development was starting to be proposed in certain ways, I think there were some of those that saw coastal zone management as being a tool that the environmental community could use to slow things down.
Jewell is working on ideas that will continue the program's operations with at least some of its original elements. He says he understands that resource development is necessary for immediate and long-term needs, but he says that people in local communities need to be included as plans develop if developers want to see quick action to carry their projects forward.
Recourse of input that people currently have is through the court system, which is unfortunate. And that's what we're trying to claw back is how do we set up a conduit with these proposed things for local involvement that's meaningful. We can enjoy some of the development of our resources, but still keep a watchful eye.
Juneau Representative Beth Curtula was the state's attorney for coastal management for 5 years during the 90s. She disagrees with the idea that the program is a burden. She says developers see local involvement as a complication to their own plans and they feel threatened by it. However, she says, they're failing to see the economic advantages of the state system. It avoids last-minute permit rejects. It brings money into the state. It helps avoid sometimes lengthy litigation.
The other thing is that coastal zone is a really big state's right hook. The only way we get a say over federal projects is to say that it impacts our coastal zone. If we don't have that tool, we're denied a seat at the table to have any impact. It's all federal agencies at that point. So if you're wanting to see development on federal lands, you know, that impact our coastal zone, the only hook you've got is through coastal zone management.
Right now, the Coastal Management Program is undergoing a legislative audit of its operations in anticipation of an attempt to delay the closure of the office by at least a year. A simple extension likely would pass and be signed by the governor. Jewell says he'll continue to work for changes that'll be acceptable to the administration that would bring back some of the more inclusive elements of the program during that extension. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The Alaska Peninsula community of Port Hyden has been struggling with aggressive wolves for the past several months. Pets have been killed, and the wolves are not easily ran off. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Wildlife Division Supervisor Bruce Dale says the state has decided it's become a public safety issue. He says they will take action similar to last spring after wolves killed a teacher 50 miles across the peninsula in Chignik Lake.
We'll go out there with fixed-wing aircraft and track wolves and trying to determine from tracks which wolves nearby there have been going into the village, and then we'll shoot them from a helicopter, and then we'll collect biological samples and remove them.
Dale says it's unlikely that the wolves bothering Port Hyden residents are from the same pack that was responsible for the Chignik Lake killing. In that incident, state hunters killed 8 wolves. Dale says they haven't yet determined how many wolves will have to be shot near Port Hyden because accounts vary as to how many are in the area. He says it's rare for North American wolves to be as aggressive as the peninsula wolves have been.
It's not rare in other parts of the world with wolves. Russia, India, they're encounters and fatal encounters are much more common.
He says several factors may be contributing to the wolves' behavior. A substantial number of the Northern Alaska Peninsula caribou herd winter close to Port Hyden, and marine mammal carcasses wash up in the area and wolves feed on them. And Dale says it's also where wolves hunt sea otters on the ice.
So there's another source of food when the pack ice forms. And in addition, the topography of the area with the coast and then Aniatic Jack Crater kind of forms a funnel there. So any animals moving through, migrating, are going to frequent that area fairly close to Port Hyden.
Dale says the fact that Port Hyden villagers have killed 6 wolves since August and others were not deterred was part of what led to the decision to kill more.
The number of wolves coming in and the frequency that they're coming in is increased. And usually that would be a decrease. That's an unusual situation. But they aren't coming in during the day now. They're only coming in at night, and that actually increases the problem. There's a lot of darkness out there this time of year, but people still have to go about their business.
Dale says pilots will backtrack wolves to locate those involved in the village incidents. Weather and snow conditions will determine when the wolves will be taken. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the need for rescue tugs in the Aleutians.
Everyone would agree it's nice to have a rescue tug, but the question is how is it going to be funded?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson spokesman had no comment today regarding the plight of Specialist Bo Bergdahl, the Fort Richardson-based soldier now being held by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Bergdahl, 24, from Haley, Idaho, was spotted in a video released recently by the Taliban. Bergdahl has been held for the past 18 months. He is a member of the 1st Battalion, 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment, 4th Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Bergdahl disappeared in June of last year from Paktika Province in eastern Pakistan. The most recent video is the fourth in which he has appeared, although authorities do not know when it was filmed. The latest video appeared on the website of the Afghan Taliban on December 2nd. Senate Democrats failed today to move forward on a defense bill that included ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Republicans shot down a procedural vote on the defense authorization bill, making slimmer the chances of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell this year. Senator Lisa Murkowski was being watched as a crucial vote, but she stuck with her party. Only GOP Senator Susan Collins of Maine voted to bring the bill to the floor. Murkowski said yesterday she wanted to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but she wanted to see many days of debate and discussion on the floor. She says Democrats were not willing to allow for enough time and were rushing it through, so she voted no.
This is not a vote on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This is a vote on moving to the defense authorization bill. This is a huge bill in terms of not only the dollars that are involved, but the authorizations that are in place and the controversy that is associated with it. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is one part of defense authorization.
Senator Mark Begich voted with all other Democrats except for West Virginia's Joe Manchin to move forward on the defense bill. The final vote was 57 to 40, three votes short of the needed 60. President Obama weighed in this evening in a statement saying he was extremely disappointed and calling to task Republicans who he said were a minority, quote, standing in the way of the funding upon which our troops, veterans, and military families depend. On Tuesday, the 738-foot bulk tank ship Golden Seas was successfully towed into the port of Dutch Harbor 4 days after issuing a distress call. Now the state of Alaska and conservation groups alike are reconsidering emergency preparedness in the Aleutian Islands. The Golden Seas had lost power and went adrift 70 miles north of Adak. There was initial concern that the vessel, which was carrying approximately 500,000 gallons of fuel and oil, could run aground and cause a spill. Though the Golden Seas ultimately regained partial power, an ocean-going tug was still needed to assist the vessel and tow it to a port of refuge. The icebreaker Tor Viking had been moored in Unalaska and was able to reach the Golden Seas within a day. But usually, there aren't any ocean-going tugs in Unalaska. The Tor Viking was there under contract with Shell Oil, which is preparing for exploratory drilling in the Beaufort Sea. No dedicated rescue tugs are stationed in the Aleutians region. There is one rescue tug available in Cook Inlet on standby for tankers, and there are a few in Prince William Sound. Leslie Pearson, a member of the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment Facilitation Team, says these could take a week to get to a distressed vessel near Adak or Atka. She says there's also one other possibility.
Your third option is Seattle, and once again, you've got, 10 to 12 days before they could even get to the location. And typically, when a situation like this occurs, you don't have the luxury of time.
Lack of rescue tugs has been a consistent problem in the region. In 2004, the vessel Celandang IU went aground and caused an oil spill, partially because the tugs available were not powerful enough to prevent it from running aground. Gary Folley is on-scene coordinator for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and he says that the Golden Seas incident could have been worse and might have substantially affected the area's fisheries.
Had the vessel grounded and spilled its fuel oil, we would have been facing a very difficult cleanup. Even, I think, a bit more so than the Celandang IU because the area was a bit more remote.
Right now, the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment Team is drafting a report on emergency response. The risk assessment is part of a cooperative effort between the state, the Coast Guard, and the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Their goal is to reduce the number of accidents in the Aleutians. Right now, they are considering the possibility of maintaining a dedicated rescue tug in the Aleutians on a permanent or seasonal basis. They're also looking at the possibility of stationing an all-purpose tug in the region that could be used in case of emergencies. The problem, says Folley, is finding the resources to do this.
I think just about everyone would agree it's nice to have a rescue tug, but the question is how is it going to be funded?
According to a traffic study report by the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment Project, more than 2,000 vessels pass through the region on an annual basis. Shauna Larson, who works with the nonprofit Pacific Environment, says that number will only increase.
Because climate change is happening so rapidly, everybody is talking about how shipping will be ramping up in Arctic waters.
A new Aleutian Islands risk assessment report should be forthcoming in the spring, the state's folly says. In the meantime, the cargo vessel Golden Seas is undergoing repairs in Unalaska. It's expected to depart for the United Arab Emirates by the end of the week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
The Fairbanks Borough Air Pollution Control Commission met last night to go over proposed changes to a fine particulate control ordinance. Borough administration has removed smoke fines from the legislation in response to a voter-approved ballot measure that prevents the borough from banning, prohibiting, or fining residents for use of heating devices. The revised ordinance also removes a smoke opacity standard as a means to assessing stack emissions. Air Pollution Control Commission member and fine particulate researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Kathy Cahill, lobbied for keeping an opacity standard in the ordinance.
You know, you're removing the opacity and you're removing the actual measurement. You've just completely and totally destroyed it. I think we need to actually have concentrations in here. And maybe there's not a fine because the proposition said we can't have a fine, but there has to be education. There has to be some consequence to doing this and having high emissions coming from your stack influencing your neighbors and their health.
Cahill suggested using opacity violations as a way to trigger a visit from borough officials to provide education on clean burning. Medical research has shown breathing the tiny particles produced by combustion of wood, coal, and other fuels, including oil, to be hazardous to health, and local research points to wood smoke as a major contributor to Fairbanks' wintertime fine particulate pollution problem. There was a lot of public testimony taken at last night's meeting. Fairbanks resident Tim Subdi challenged the validity of fine particulate science and the legality of forcing education on polluters.
Another item tonight that really scares me is, well, we got to keep the opacity in so that we'll have a trigger so that we can then have a government official come and have a chat with you. Well, that's called harassment. That is also a violation of a person's civil rights.
Most testimony came from the other side. People talked about smoke infiltrating homes and schools and health problems brought on by it. Some called the voter pass ban on borough smoke enforcement unconstitutional. Fairbanks resident Sean McGuire urged commissioners to challenge Prop A in court.
I think you guys should stand as a body and say, look, this is a public health issue. It's something that we can't ignore. It trumps everything else.
Others said the borough's draft amendments go too far in responding to a voter pass proposition. The amended fine particulate ordinance deletes a standard for moisture content of wood, but retains restrictions on burning garbage, tires, and some other non-wood fuels. Borough attorney Renee Broker says there's room for clamping down on polluters by taking them to court for creating a nuisance, as long as the problem isn't the result of normal stove or boiler operation.
We would instead be filing nuisance actions for the, 10,000 other ways somebody could create a nuisance by improperly operating their wood stove, maybe burning tires, whatever. We would be in front of a court, so people's rights, and they could argue whether or not, it would be properly vetted or whether or not we were applying it correctly, as opposed to trying to have a code enforcement officer out there making those type of decisions.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation can enforce clean air standards regardless of the voter-instituted restraints on the borough. Fairbanks has until 2014 to get into compliance with federal fine particulate pollution standards. Local air has dipped into the unhealthy range in Fairbanks this week due to elevated fine particulate concentrations. The U.S. Department of Justice has corrected a mistake they made identifying a defendant that was arrested in a bust of a drug trafficking ring in Alaska. But it meant for one weekend, a Kenai Peninsula woman was worried her reputation was incorrectly tainted. KDLL's Ben Stanton has more.
You might remember a story about a month ago about 19 Alaskans that were arrested for drug trafficking and money laundering. It involved moving prescription painkillers from Las Vegas to Alaska for distribution. A list of Alaskan suspects was provided by attorneys in the case, and that list included the name Kathleen Haley of Sterling. The woman involved is actually Kathleen Rennie. But there is a woman in Sterling named Kathleen Haley. And after the news broke, she was quite surprised. So it was, too, for family and friends that saw her name in the news.
Their initial reaction, my brother almost dropped the phone. He was laughing so hard. When I called to warn him that this was happening, I had a call from a friend that said, you know, I'm calling to see if you need bail money. She said, but, you know, what I'm really calling is, I know you won't even know this going on if I don't tell you.
Despite the lighthearted initial reaction, Haley says she was a little worried. Haley was previously Kathleen Rennie, that's Kathleen with a K, as opposed to the real defendant, Kathleen with a C, but it changed to Haley through marriage. She still receives mail occasionally with the name Kathleen Rennie. Haley heard the news about her supposed arrest on a Friday and attempted to contact authorities to offer a correction, but it was the following Monday before she was able to speak to the proper officials. That meant days of uncertainty and worry that people would mistakenly believe she was somehow involved. Now the U.S. attorney involved in the case asked that the name Kathleen Haley be stricken from the record. A magistrate signed an order to that effect last week. Haley says the lesson she learned was to stick with her principles and not to resort to blaming others for her situation.
People wanted me to accuse Kathleen Rennie. They wanted me to accuse the papers. They wanted me to accuse, you know, and I just knew that was the thing not to do. That is, that, you know, the mercy that you mete out is meant back to you.
Haley is a lifelong Alaska resident who's a former teacher. She currently helps operate the Great Alaska Adventure Lodge in Sterling. The other Kathleen, defendant Kathleen Rennie, if convicted of drug trafficking and money laundering, could face decades of prison time and over $1 million in fines. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ben Stanton in Kenai. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.